Hey everyone, welcome to episode 135 of Rain Delay Radio. This is Dylan. I'm on hosting duties today with a few of our other co-hosts out and about. But I have a very special guest joining us today. We go way back actually to our college newspaper. It's Chase Kitty. He's the odds analyst at BetMGM and the host of the Lion's Edge podcast. What's up, Chase?
Hello. Yes. Many years back. You and I go
and all
Richmond podcast tonight. I don't know where everybody else is from,
but, absolutely.
All Richmond podcast. Enjoy the light sounds of rain in the background.
Yeah. I was, you know, mentioning before we started, I'm really hoping that we don't like lose power at the exact same time, because I think we're within a mile of each other here. So, maybe that's good for certain things and not so good when a storm is right over top of both of us. But, first of all, go
you
Dukes.
You might be on a hospital grid. You might
it's
be
true.
Fine. I'm
close enough, you know, so we'll see. So first news for us is go Dukes, so that we get that
go
out
Dukes.
Of the way.
Yep.
And so Chase, like I mentioned before, he works a lot with BetMGM. He podcasts for BetMGM. So kind of as much of a gambling expert as I know. And I know a lot of people might call themselves gambling experts, but I have seen your process and I've seen the way you do things. And I would certainly say you qualify that title. And you're also a big Orioles fan. So I think now is as good a time as any to talk about any of that.
Yeah, a nice come-up story both for JMU and the Orioles the last couple of years.
Yes.
So, West Virginia's been in a better place, so I can't say across the board.
Right.
Everybody's doing great, but it's a fun couple of years to be a JMU fan and an Orioles fan.
Yeah. So we're going to do a little bit of the general stuff that we normally do. We did already cover some of the trade deadline stuff. If anyone missed our episode, it probably went up like Wednesday morning. It was me and Pat reacting to a lot of the big deals that went down. Kind of a weird deadline. Nothing like, I mean, I guess past the Mets, there wasn't anything that felt substantial. Obviously, the Mets went kind of wild, but there's lots of interesting things that I enjoyed talking to Pat about on that. Maybe if you're more inside baseball than kind of broad picture, it was a good deadline. But now we're going to get into some of the things that have kind of happened in the last few days. And really, I mean, the trade deadline's fun, but what's more fun is two grown men trying to fight each other on a baseball diamond. And we got that. It was yesterday. Was it midday yesterday? Yesterday evening?
I was in a plane, so I'm not sure, but I definitely got the push notification as soon as I landed. I was like, oh, what happened here?
Yeah, I think that was sort of my experience, was I wasn't watching the game. And then I saw a bunch of people blowing up about it, online, and boy was it worth checking in on. For those, I can't imagine anyone that would possibly listen to this podcast doesn't know that this happened, but just in case, White Sox shortstop Tim Anderson, Jose Ramirez of the Guardians, there's kind of a play at second. I think Ramirez is going in a little hard and Tim Anderson kind of maybe like hits him on the glove, you know, hits him with the glove kind of hard. Whatever happened, they're sharing words. And Tim squares up to, you know, fight Jose. They share a few blows. And the last one that Jose lands on Tim seems to be the one that everyone's going to remember, because it definitely had shades of Rougned Odor, Jose Bautista, where, you know, one of those shots stuck out more than the other. And Tim was out today with concussion protocol. So just to give an idea of kind of the impact of what happened here. Down goes Anderson was the amazing, amazing radio call from last night. So, I mean, I think my first thing here was, I don't know if it's possible for one guy to have just like an established, I would say, MLB star, have like a worse season just from like a spectator point of view. Like, and this just felt like the exclamation point for Tim Anderson's awful year.
Yeah. How about you get clocked in the face? Like, you're like, you thought your power numbers were down? Well,
like there's adding insult to injury. And then I think this is like
adding injury
more
to insult to injury.
Yeah, it's just more, it's a definite injury and even like doubling on the insult. So, I was listening to Effectively Wild. I think this was like yesterday, like earlier in the day, but it was like the episode from like earlier this week. So before this had happened, and first part of their episode was about a Nolan Ryan and Robin Ventura fight from decades ago. It was like, you know, the famous clip of Nolan Ryan putting Robin Ventura in the headlock, you know? And there's some people out there that think Robin Ventura was kind of like, he didn't get a fair shake maybe in the history of this all, because the fight did continue and Robin got some shots in and things like that, right? And so, you know, they're like, well, you got to give Robin Ventura a little bit more credit in that fight as opposed to just him being the guy that was in the headlock. But I think I saw another comment that said Tim Anderson could be the Robin Ventura of this generation, which just holds so much weight. Like, it's one of the more incredible observations I think I've ever heard of everything that Tim Anderson has done to this point. And he's been a very newsworthy guy. You know, I think especially the like Field of Dreams game, right? Like, that was like a big moment for him. You know, the White Sox have had some big seasons. He's been at the front of that. Now in the middle of his worst season, the White Sox worst season, he is now going to be known as the guy that got socked by Jose Ramirez, right?
Socked. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to overplay a punch in the grand scheme of an 162 game season, but this punch was so bad. My wife saw it on Instagram, and my wife doesn't follow sports at all. And she like was in bed this morning and rolled over and was like, "Hey, what's up with this fight in the White Sox game?"
Did you watch the White Sox and Guardians game last night?
Is this new, or is this just like some clip from yesteryear? And I was like, wow, this thing has officially jumped the pop culture shark if my wife is getting served this on Instagram.
This really got around.
It's mostly dog videos and like car crash simulations in her feed and Real Housewives.
It was like the punch heard around the world. Like, you're one of the few friends that I have in person that actually cares about baseball. And all of my like close friends that I was like, "Hey, did y'all see this?" Like, they all saw it and were like, "Whoa!" Like, it gets the people going. It's like a giant crash in NASCAR or something like that. It's one of those things that happens where it doesn't really matter who you are, you're going to be drawn to it. And that's the devastating part about it for Tim Anderson. Is that I think all the people that already know who he is are now going to associate with him with this punch. All the people who didn't know who he was are going to associate him with the punch. You know, like, he was introduced to a legion of new people because he was the one drilled. And like, he was the one that seemed to like instigate the actual fighting itself. And the, you know, the brawl went on for a while after that was done. And he, you know, kept wanting to go.
He tried to come back out.
Andrew Vaughn literally had to carry him off. Like, Andrew Vaughn's a pretty big dude. And like, he just had him in a vice grip basically. But, you know, and Tim, I think, got a couple shots on Jose Ramirez, but it was that last one. And it almost seemed like Jose was done because it was like, he was kind of fading away a little bit, you know? But because he got that kind of, this is like a boxing podcast now. It was like that full arm extension he got on the right that just made it, connected so hard.
It connected so hard because you're exactly right. We're talking about this like it's an MMA podcast now, but not that I'm some fighting expert, but it would have been better if he had been tighter to Ramirez's body because he was so far back. And when you have those big, like long, curving, arching hooks like Ramirez throws, the distance is actually a deficit for you. It's actually a negative if you're taking the punch, and he just squares them so tight that, yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at Tim Anderson's Wikipedia page. That's definitely first paragraph in there now, right? I mean, somebody went in there and cleaned it up after last night, and that's for sure happened.
Oh, yeah, like someone was definitely saying, like, you know, Father Jose Ramirez or something like that. You know, that's the easiest Wikipedia
edit
of all time. So yeah, I mean, I think that I was wondering, like, thinking of, you know, I try to think like, oh, what are we going to think about the podcast like this weekend? You know, whoever's doing it, if it's me or someone else. And I was like, there hasn't really been too much going on because we just did the trade deadline and Tim Anderson and Jose Ramirez.
There's your lead.
Yeah, you know, kudos to them. Like, they like resuscitated, you know, all of baseball discourse over the last, you know, 4 days. So that was pretty sick. So highly recommend, if anyone hadn't seen it, check out every angle. Definitely get the Guardians radio broadcast, because that's maybe the funniest version of this. Apparently that broadcast clip was going through, or the radio broadcast clip was going through other MLB clubhouses, because there was reports that the Yankees and Astros were both listening to it in their clubhouse before the game today. So this is a giant deal for, you know, some comedic reasons, some serious reasons. I think the main thing from here is how hurt is Tim Anderson? I don't know. I guess it doesn't really matter, but, like, you know, concussions are a big deal. And how much are they going to be suspended, and who is going to be suspended? So I don't know if that stuff has worked out yet as of this is Sunday evening. So that'll probably be the thing to we're waiting on. But for now, we just get to revel in how absurd it is. So that's great for us. The other things that kind of going on the last few days is kind of what I mentioned before with the trade deadline fallout, just kind of seeing how teams are adapting with their new players. There's a few teams that were really trying to make their kind of last pushes, kind of rounding out their roster. Like I mentioned, not a lot of huge players that are moving, but, you know, we got to see Scherzer for the first time as a Ranger. We got to see Justin Verlander's return as an Astro. It happened very fast. And then some of these other guys that have been plugged in. The Cubs notoriously... they've won 2 out of 3 against the Braves after picking up Jamer Candelario. And then some others have actually struggled. I think the Diamondbacks and the Marlins are like falling like a rock in their standings. But I did want to touch upon the Angels in particular, because they were kind of the headline of trade deadline season. And Chase, I know you probably haven't listened to much of our stuff here, but I feel like the Angels have come up like quite a bit, as far as just how much we felt bad for them and how much, because they're always being talked about, right? Because Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout are on the team.
Sure.
But nothing seems to go right, and this just seems to follow. It was almost too easy to predict, right? Almost like they can't screw it up that bad, right? And then they have lost 6 games in a row. So I don't know. I think Fangraphs has their playoff chances down to 3 or 4% now. As someone that is in the gambling industry, I don't know if you're feeling any better about it. I would be a little bit surprised if you were, but just them going all in, getting Giolito and a handful of these other veterans, and then just immediately seeming like their chances have cratered is a really sad situation for them and kind of baseball, since Ohtani is attached to that train wreck.
Yeah, I mean, there's the math part of it where they're 7 games back in the wild card standings,
yeah,
with 49 games left. And then there's like, I think the more interesting part of it is the superstar acquiescence part of it. I would compare it almost to an NBA team where, like, all right, compare them to the Mavericks, maybe, because that's probably the best comp I have off the top of my head.
I thought the same thing, yeah.
Which, you know, the Mavericks last year spend capital to bring in Kyrie Irving, who is an expiring contract and could hypothetically walk out the door. That's an oversimplified version of what happened. But yeah, you do it because you have to show the effort to Luka Doncic, because if he feels like you're half-assing it, he can leave. He can leave at any time in free agency, and there will be a massive bidding war, and he could go wherever he wanted. And Dallas is, I wouldn't call it a small market, but it's a smaller market than maybe some of the major places in NBA. And I feel like that's the only explanation for what the Angels did, because this team is not close. It's just not remotely close to being competitive at any level that really matters. They're in a tough division. I mean, the Rangers are good. The Astros have made like 6 straight ALCS series.
The Mariners are the hottest team in baseball.
Exactly. So, like, you feel for them a little on that level. But, I mean, what are you doing going all in like this on a team that's just obviously not there, and your path is so hard and getting worse? They lost in extras today, Sunday afternoon, to Seattle. It's just like, I don't. Other than that sort of like pseudo psychological framing where you're trying to show Ohtani how bad you want it so that he doesn't go play for the Yankees when his contract's up. I don't know what the hell's going on. I don't know what they're doing.
Like, we mentioned this a little bit when Pat and I were talking about it, and I think the industry, like, I follow a lot of writers, follow a lot of podcasters, follow people that are just, like, thinking about this stuff, and I do think people appreciated the idea of the Angels not just folding on their season, right? Like, they had a chance, squeeze out what you can. I mean, if you lose Ohtani, which seems like they might, like, that, why would, you know, of course, like, gonna be terrible. Like, there's like no possible way for this team to ever be good in the Trout era if Ohtani leaves. Like, they just don't have enough. Even if they traded for really good prospects, like, there's just not gonna be enough there, right? And it's relying on a team that's just continually never develops guys to develop these prospects that they get back. So I do understand why they did what they did, right? But there's a special level of, you know, irony or whatever you want to call it, that the Angels just decide, you know what, let's go all in, let's show Ohtani that we're, you know, here to play, we're here to win, we're gonna make a run at this thing, and then they can't even get out of the week with a win, you know. It's just like there's a certain devastation that I think only Angels fans must experience like this, because I can't think of a parallel of a team like this where you were just, everyone's begging them to figure it out and they just can't figure it out. Is it like the Knicks kind of like, but the Knicks have had more successful runs than this, you know? I don't know what the comparison point is.
And I don't know. I mean, it's such a unique situation to have generational transformational talent, probably multiple players who fit that description and to be this, it's not bad. It's actually worse than bad.
Yeah.
It's forgettable.
Yeah.
It's
completely
so
mediocre.
Not relevant.
Yeah.
Like, there's an argument that Oakland, the last place team in this division, is actually more relevant than the Angels because Oakland is so bad and there's so much disaster zone happening with that team and the impending move, it seems, to Las Vegas and like all this other stuff. They're actually more relevant than the Angels because they're so bad. And the Angels is just like, what are they? Oh, yeah, they're a couple games near 500.
Randall Gritch at cleanup. Yep.
Probably not going to make the playoffs. Yep. Again. Okay.
It's brutal. And I was one of those people, and a lot of us are. We're just, maybe they'll figure it out. Maybe Lucas Giolito will be enough. And maybe these, you know, because what they've struggled with is putting just guys that are just like major league caliber around Trout and Ohtani, right? That's been the issue for years and years and years, especially throughout the Trout only era, right? Was that they spent so much money on either pricey guys or even mid price guys. Think of Ian Kinsler coming to the Angels and all these other guys, and they just don't either get hurt or suck, you know? And this is just like, you can't afford to lose six games, the most pinnacle part of your season, you know, and it's just so bad. And they're basically cooked minus like the most freak show recovery ever, you know, like if the Angels made the playoffs now, even just snuck in, like, I think it would be the biggest story in baseball by like a mile, you know, like it would have to be that substantial of a turnaround. And you know, Giolito just gave up 8 runs to the Braves. Like, he might be an upgrade for them, but are they going to be able to rip off, like, what would it take, like 30 of their next 40 to get in?
I mean, it would be a lot. And then it would be a lot if they had an easy schedule.
Yeah.
But you look at their schedule starting this week, it's Giants, Astros, Rangers, Rays, Reds, Mets, Phillies. That's their August
That's
schedule.
That's horrible.
Like,
I did not even see that.
It's not happening. That's not happening.
Yeah.
So, thanks for playing, but you're not making the playoffs.
So, I guess, no. Ohtani will try to put a cap on. I mean, Mike Petriello called this the greatest baseball season ever played, and I think there's definitely a case to be made for it, you know, as far as him himself. And the fact that you can't, they might not even sniff the playoffs is just, baseball is a weird sport. You know, it's just it's almost impossible to fathom. You know, like, if you're talking about Babe Ruth you know, and like, oh my God, Babe Ruth could do everything. He was, you know, home run king. He did all this stuff. Oh yeah, the Yankees were also terrible. they could never make it. They never accomplished anything. It just doesn't click. You know, when you're talking about these historic figures of this sport and even any other sport, you know, they almost all do something. You know, maybe Dan Marino, you know, like, but Dan Marino was never, I don't think, this level transcendent. Maybe there's a case to be made there, but anyway, we'll move on from the Angels once again. I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about the betting stuff, since that's obviously in your wheelhouse. You know, maybe as these lines and, you know, divisional races are shifting, I wanted to poke around and see, you know, how maybe the gambling world is interacting with these moves that the teams have made, or any big shifts in the way teams are playing. If there's any trends you notice there that are worth like discussing or highlighting, that you find particularly interesting, and I'll kind of leave an open floor for that.
Yeah. So I think we haven't seen a ton of movement yet. Post trade deadline, I think some sports you can sometimes see really dramatic moves, mainly basketball. Mm. I think baseball, even when you add big players, even when you're talking about, you know, the Astros adding Verlander back to the pitching rotation, generally you don't see a ton of big movements. I think the Astros went in the AL pennant race, I think they went from like 4-1 to 7-2. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not super dramatic. We might see, you know, because baseball is such an exercise in the law of large numbers, as we go through August and as we get more and more series under the post deadline belt, I think you might see some of that, you know, movement you're talking about. But I really think, for the most part, this is a sport where you see slow changes in numbers. I think the much more interesting thing that I draw from the futures markets, when you look at both the World Series market and the pennant markets, because you can bet both, is I always find it fascinating where people put their money. And without fail, usually people are chasing the mid-sized return or even the big return. So like your Braves, Dylan, are, you know, astronomical favorites in the NL pennant race.
Don't tell them.
They're the favorite right now. That, yeah, they can, if they win the World Series this year, they could take a victory lap like your Chiefs did last year, where they said how nobody believed in them.
Absolutely.
Which was so stupid. But I mean, they're plus 150 right now to win the NL pennant.
That's so crazy.
The Dodgers are plus 200. Nobody else is closer than 10-1. So that's shocking. I mean, that's how top heavy that market is. And the Braves, you know, the Braves have had a good couple of years here. So you have people that are willing to buy the Braves. It's about 1/8 of the market is on the Braves to win the NL pennant. But when you look at the Dodgers at 2-1, there's so much less appetite to buy that team because it's, you know, it's a pretty shallow return. And the Dodgers at best are sort of plateaued from where they've been the last 5 or 6 or 7 years.
Right.
It's less than 5% of the whole market is on the Dodgers. And if you go back even just a year or two, that would be a way bigger number. There's always public interest in buying the Dodgers. So it's much more the public, because they, you know, they chase what they call it value. When you talk to like an average bettor, they'll say, oh, I like value. What they really mean is return. What they really mean is I like a big number next to the plus sign so that if I win, I'm going to win a lot of money. And so in that vein, the ticket in the National League market that is more popular among bettors than anybody else, including the Braves, it's not even particularly close, is actually the Cincinnati Reds. The Reds opened, this isn't even the World Series market. This is just the NL pennant market. They opened at 80-1.
Oh, man.
And they're now 25-1. So they've come down a lot because of, you know, what's happened with that team. And it's particularly like, you know, they peaked kind of in early or mid June, it felt like, and they really had a moment for a few weeks and they got really popular. But almost 20% of the entire NL market is on Cincinnati at that number.
Holy crap. That's crazy.
It is. And I think it would be pretty weird if Cincinnati won the National League this year. You know?
I think it would be pretty weird if Cincinnati ever won the National League again. Like, that's the kind of team that I've experienced as the Cincinnati Reds my entire lifetime is, right. Why should I ever care?
Yes.
Now, you know, it's the most exciting team, not only for a lot of people, but in the betting market, it sounds like.
Scrappy National League wildcard team, perhaps. You know, tough out in the divisional series, perhaps. But
maybe
it doesn't really feel like they're live to win the NL, but people see those big numbers. It's kind of the same with my Orioles in the American League. Now I think the Orioles have a little more meat to them. I think there's fair questions about some of the starting pitching, though. Flaherty, I think the addition there is a nice add at the trade deadline. But people love the idea that the Orioles opened the AL pennant market at 18-1, and they're now 6-1, and they're the most bet AL team in the pennant market because people like the return.
The Orioles we'll definitely get into more because of your fandom, but I think both the Orioles and the Reds, the Orioles at least added Flaherty, which you can see that upside paying off for them, right? He's been all crap basically for the last couple of years because of injuries and stuff, but like he was throwing 97 the other day, like in his first start with the Orioles. Like, you can envision a universe where he's a benefit for they didn't go crazy, but like Reds felt like, especially in that division, is just like they made one move for just a random veteran. If they got Lance Lynn now or something stupid like that, it would just be like, wouldn't that make so much sense for them just to have like capable pitching, you know, next to this rookie? Like, Andrew Abbott's basically their only good pitcher, and he's 80 innings into his major league career, and he's a former UVA guy, which does not well for pitching just broadly. That's kind of been a problem for lots of UVA guys, is that they explode at some point, unfortunately. But you know, I mean, he's been amazing, but relying on him as your ace until Hunter Green and then we're back, it was just, I was so frustrated with their deadline because it felt like they had everything kind of working in their favor. You know, you could make small moves on the kind of fringes to make it better, and now, I mean, basically, I think either right after the deadline or as the deadline is happening, the Cubs just shellacked them. Like, it was just like gross. You know, like, I think they put up 36 runs in two of those games or something like that. So, you know,
3-7 their last 10 games, one of the worst power rankings in handicapping right now. Cincinnati runs.
Ellie is an amazing talent, but like, you can't expect him to be like that great already. He can't hit lefties yet. You know, he still strikes out a lot. He's really exciting and he's really good, but like, he's going to have holes this early in his career. He's 20 years old. You know, so I you know, they'd be really exciting, like you said, if they got to the playoffs, if they're able to like shock some teams with their kind of, you know, young offense. But they were a really disappointing team for me, that they weren't trying to take advantage a little bit of that spark they had, because it felt significant to me. Whereas
if the playoffs started today, the Reds are in.
I mean, and that means a lot, especially when you see the teams around them. Like I said, I mentioned before, Diamondbacks and the Marlins were buyers, and they're kind of in similar situations where they're like, hey, we got enough talent, we got a good record, let's step on the gas pedal a little bit and we'll figure something out. Not a lot, maybe not enough, you know, but they've both cratered like really, really hard. I think each team has got like 5 wins in the last, you know, 3-4 weeks, you know? So the NL wildcard is just, you know, it's all over the place, and I see why. Even still, the Reds are like, well, if they're at that price, you know, screw it. Like, it doesn't really matter. And with the Orioles, kind of the same deal. Like, I guess I'd be curious if the betting lines, you know, signal this. Like, are the Astros considered with Verlander like the top team, like in the AL clearly now? Or are the Orioles still kind of holding on to that at the top? Like, what is the market thinking about the American League and the top teams?
Well, if you're looking at the market numbers, they like Houston. And I think part of that is the history that they've been in the ALCS. They've either won it or been in it like six straight years. So right now the numbers are plus 375 for Houston. And then it's actually the Rangers behind them at plus 400. And they've kind of been right on top of each other the last few weeks. Like a week ago, Houston was... it's actually 2 weeks ago now. Houston was plus 400. The Rangers were plus 450. And then Tampa is plus 325 right now, too. So actually, I totally missed that. Tampa is actually the top of the market, which to me seems like a totally outdated number. I mean, if it was May, that makes sense. And look, you give the nod to Tampa because you understand that once you get to the postseason, there's such a premium on like reliable pitching, and Tampa has proven they have that year in and year out. And that's
no matter who's on the roster, basically.
Exactly. And even this year, like when Tampa's good, it's because they have like super solid pitching, you know? And when they recede, it's because they don't necessarily get the run support they need to support even good pitching. Like you do have to have a baseline of run support at some point to win baseball games, and that's certainly true in the postseason too. But I understand why that number is where it is, but to me, like if I'm getting involved in an AL pennant market, there's no way I want Tampa at the top of the market. There's no way I want Tampa at 325. So I do agree with, I think, the plurality of bettors that look at Baltimore and go, if you're making me take a side, sure, I like the 6-1 in that roster over something like Tampa at half the return. I'd probably look at Texas. Like, I think that's the best blend of the offense and the number at 4-1. And like, I think I would want a Rangers position more than I would want any of these other things.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you. And the Rangers have done the thing that, like, you wonder how the Angels never figured it out even one time, but they got a bunch of young guys that can play, you know, and it's not they're not all stars, you know what I mean? Like, Josh Young actually got hurt within the last day, so he might be out for a little bit, but like, Josh Young is a really good hitter. He's not like special, but he's really good. Ezekiel Duran will just fill in for Josh Young, I guess. He's just good. Adolis Garcia was a DFA and now he's an all-star and he's like leading the league in RBIs or whatever. Like a lot of Travis Jankowski, like how can we like make that like a real player? But they have, you know, so they have a lot of guys next to these Corey Seegers and Marcus Semiens of the world and they lost to Grom and we're still talking about them as like, well, it might be the favorite for the AL pennant, right? Because they have other good players and they built a complete roster. So yeah, I think I'm definitely in agreement, and their offense is just nuts, and their pitching, even if it's like kind of thrown together, it's deep and it's solid, and that's kind of what you need, right? And especially with Scherzer now just like plugged in right at the front, it's a fascinating team. I have no, like, I feel like the Rangers are one of those teams that I've never had any opinion about in my entire life. I don't know if you have teams like that in any of the sports you watch, but like they had their little moment in like the late 2000s, but have otherwise been so irrelevant to me because of proximity or the way they are. You know, they've just burned money and haven't really done much. So this feels like it's leading up to something big for them, whether it's this year, next year, whatever. But
Well, they already created a U.S. president. Dylan.
Right.
So, I mean,
maybe it was the George Bush influence where I'm just like, I'm too focused on my distaste of George Bush to, think critically about the Texas Rangers. let's dig into the Orioles a little bit. And you can come from this whatever angle you want, but just to start, if you wanted to give people an idea of, your history with the Orioles, your fandom, you know, based on what we mentioned before, we're both from the Richmond area, different parts, but you know, we grew up the Richmond Braves and stuff. So I kind of gravitated that way. So what got you into the Orioles, you know, and when was that?
Well, so like growing up playing Little League in, you know, Chesterfield, which is what you're referencing outside of Richmond. Yeah. And then even before that, like when I was a kid in West Virginia, we didn't have the Nats when we were kids. So like the nearest team, I mean, this is like the height of like the consecutive games Ripken streak, and when I'm a kid And, you know, my father took me to Pirates games, but you have kind of a weird history with the city of Pittsburgh when you're from West Virginia.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of what happens is you're just looking for some kind of local involvement. And you know, I got drafted by the Orioles by geography, I think the same way that a lot of people do. And it was, you know, a really fun team when I was in college. And when I was in college, I had a lot of baseball internships, and it kind of like reignited my love with the sport, because I understood it on a deeper level than I was when I was a kid or when I was playing it or whatever. And that 2014 team that went to the ALCS and lost to the Royals, like that really solidified, like, oh, I'm about the Orioles. And then 2016 happens. And 2016, they have a better season than I think a lot of people remember. You and I had taken a long car ride the year before, and you gave me like a 15-minute really solid like Reddit pitch about like, look, man, this is where the Orioles are going. And I like you kind of convinced me. And so going into 2016, I was like, I don't know. And then like they have a good year and they make the postseason. They're in the Rogers Center. They're playing the Blue Jays. It's tied 2-2 going to extra innings. Buck Showalter doesn't go to Zach Britton out of the pen. This is burned into my brain, okay?
It's burned into a lot of people's brains.
Doesn't go to Zach Britton out of the pen. What he is saving him for, I have no idea. Britton that way, I looked all of this up just to like really have the screws dialed in so people understand how ridiculous this is. Britton had an ERA that year of 0.54.
Like, I still think he should have won the Cy Young. I genuinely think that.
He had the highest war on the team of anyone not named Manny Machado. And instead of putting in Zach Britton to throw a couple innings in a winner-go-home wildcard playoff game, Buck Showalter inserts Ubaldo Jimenez, who does exactly what you think he does. He gives up one of the longest home runs I have ever seen to Encarnacion. Blue Jays win 5-2, and I swear to God, I think that ball still hasn't landed. Like, it landed in Alberta.
It just kept going through the ground.
It was like an early bat flip. Like, we didn't have bat flip culture yet. But
Blue Jays were kind of establishing that, I think, at the time.
Yeah, and when you just, like, watched this hit, you just watched the ball come off of Encarnacion's bat, you were like there's nothing your body can do anatomically but flip this bat, because it's such a preposterous home run. And, like, of course we lost that game, because there was just – and, look, I love Buck. Buck was great when he was in Baltimore, but, like, that was a stupid-ass decision. I don't know what else to call it. And it just goes downhill so fast after that. They were like, you know, a couple games under 500 in 2017. From 2018 to 2021, Baltimore was 178-368.
That sucks. So
that
bad.
Was their record for the 4-year stretch. That averages out. So, like, if you were to condense that number into one season, it's like going 53-109 for 4 straight years. That's how bad they were. They lost more than 2/3 of their games. It was really hard to be an Orioles fan in that stretch. There was nothing. There were no prospects. There was literally nothing to be excited about. Yep. Nothing good was happening. And that's such a rare thing for Baltimore, because usually Baltimore is just an explosion of sunshine and happiness. Everybody knows that. Watch The Wire. It's all about how happy everybody is in Baltimore. So it's just like last year was such a breath of fresh air of like, oh, like, can I watch Orioles games again without being super depressed? And then this, you know, they got the best record in the American League right now. It's just awesome. It's so much fun. And they're like, they play so free. I think they're as happy to be relevant as we are as fans. It's just like, oh, we don't suck. This is pretty fun. And I don't know how long you can sustain that level of like highly contextualized joy, because eventually, like, you know, reality creeps in and it's, we've got another game today. Like, that's going to happen at some point. I don't think it'll be this year, but it'll be like, you know, June 14th next year, and they're going to be in a, you know, 4-game road series in Minnesota, and they're going to be like, actually, this isn't very fun anymore, is it? But for now,
it's my fourth year doing this. Oh,
it's awesome. I love it. It's so much fun. And, you know, there's probably going to be some playoff games in Baltimore this year, and I'm pretty excited about it, and I'm thinking about tickets right now.
I am too, honestly. Like, I've never rooted for the Orioles, you know, I've never had any good reason to, but like, I don't hold second allegiances. I'm not that kind of person, you know. I'm not totally like, this is my backup team, you know.
Yep.
I basically don't have that really. But if I were to like go to a team's playoff game or something just to enjoy the vibe of what's going on, I mean, even just the rest of the season, I need to go see a game. It's the Orioles.
Camden vibes are immaculate
right
now.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you watch them on TV or you see the clips of, you know, like Gunnar's, you know, 115-mile-an-hour home run the other day. It's just like, oh my God. Like, these people are in love with these guys, you know, and there's a certain, I don't know if it's a culture shift because of the guys they've gotten, you know, Rutschman. Everyone was just expecting to just step in and be a natural leader, and voila, he is. Even if he hasn't been like a demigod like he was last year, it doesn't really matter that much if your teammates are equally as talented. You know, like, it's been really shocking to see. In the beginning of the season, I thought they were probably going to fall off a little bit because, you know, we, in the betting world, you know, I'm sure there are your own red flags, right, of things that you think of when you're thinking of, why is this team valued here, you know? And I was thinking the same way with the Orioles, where I'm like, well, they had a really nice season, right? The vibes were great. Lots of good, you know, Rutschman was coming up. We knew Henderson was on the way. Cedric has turned into a star, all these things. But, like, their bullpen was so good, and that's always the thing that screws people up, because it's always like, oh, your bullpen was good last year. That almost does like the number of times where a great bullpen is great every single year is almost non-existent, right? So it's like all those
Kansas City mid 2010s
and sometimes it wins a World Series, you know, like sometimes it works, shout out Kansas City, but like, you know, it's very rare, you know. And even that was kind of a flash in the pan in its own right. So, you know, if Bautista takes a step back, they lost Jorge Lopez. Like, they have a bunch of other guys, even in the rotation, that are just either random veterans that, or like 28-year-olds who were prospects 4 years ago. No one really knows that well. Looking at you, Mike Bauman, you know, like, how are these guys going to possibly maintain this pace they were on last year, where they're winning a lot of like one run games? And one run games are kind of like the red flag when you're thinking about how good is a team really. And they're just as good as last year at that, and then they're better at everything else. So I'm glad I was wrong. I just didn't kind of see it. I mean, did you expect that kind of success this year, or what? Like, what? There, let me rephrase, because there's no possible way you saw how good they're doing now.
Right. There's no way I was going to be like, oh, yeah, I definitely thought they'd have the best record in the American League in August. That was my expectations.
Did you think they'd be better than last year, about the same, or like feeling things out?
I thought they would slightly improve and probably make the wild card this year. Those were my expectations. And I did, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, like, I host this podcast for BetMGM, and I jump to a lot of different sports and give a lot of different market analysis and like, you know, do internal numbers, like kind of like I did with you here in this episode. So like, I did an episode before the season started about how, you know, I think it was like 4 baseball win total bets that I like. And one, and I think at the end I did a couple where I was like, yeah, I feel, here are a couple leans that I have. I'm not going to make them full bets, but like, when you looked at Baltimore, the win total was so, it felt so high. And I was like, whoa, like, I think Baltimore's going to be good this year, but I don't know if I can recommend, you know, there is, hey, I think they're going to be good. And then there's what makes financial sense in a betting market. And those two things can be related, but you can't just go like, oh, automatic over because I like this team this year. It's all about the number. That's like one of the cardinal rules of betting. And I was like, I don't know if I can, I think I might honestly take it under if I'm betting the Baltimore side this year. So it, for me, I understood where the hype was coming from, but I thought it was a classic case of like, well, the hype has now kind of jumped the shark and has overshot the results we're ultimately going to get. And that hasn't happened at all. And I think a lot of it is sort of the one run results that you're talking about. I think if you had something closer to league average on how those games panned out, then maybe this would be a little bit more of a, I don't want to say middle of the pack, but they'd be closer to the middle of the pack. They wouldn't have as much separation as they have now. But it does, you're right. I'm not disagreeing with you about the ethereal kind of nature of the one run thing and how oftentimes it can turn into mist, especially year over year. But it does also make sense from a statistical point of view that if you have a great bullpen, that you would have one run wins as a function of that bullpen because of what, not just your ability to protect tight leads, but also your ability to play in those situations because it happens so often. So this is, I mean, we went through kind of in Baltimore the exact same thing 10 years ago. The team was very similarly built to as it is right now. We didn't have as many awesome young guys 10 years ago as we did now, but it was like, hey, we hit a lot of bombs. The lineup is pretty nice. The starting pitching is the middle relievers are pretty solid. The closing rotation is epically good. And I would say that, you know, the nuances now are that I think the bullpen is not quite as good as it was 10 years ago. And, you know, 1 through 9, the guys are probably better than they were 10 years ago. So, you give a little bit here, you take a little bit there. But I do think, not to say it's like a totally statistically sustainable thing, but I think those things do play off of each other. And I think, I think they're good. I think they're really good. I think it would be weird if they won the World Series. As good as they are, I think that would be weird.
I feel that about the Braves. Like, no one ever has to convince me that, like, if anyone ever says, oh my gosh, my team is going to win the World Series and it's August, I'm like, I could never take that person seriously. You know, like, winning the World Series is always so hard and so shocking, and it doesn't matter how good your team is. You know, even Astros fans would be like, holy crap, you know, we actually did it, you know. It's kind of like the Chiefs, you know, thinking they're the underdogs or whatever. You hear enough things and you go through a season, there's no way that that's never going to feel, you're never going to be complacent about a, you know, World Series or anything. With the Orioles, like you mentioned, you know, if your bullpen is actually that good, like, sure, it makes total sense. But I think a lot of problems that teams have gotten themselves into over the last decade, you know, is that sometimes their bullpen played well, but isn't actually that good, you know, played above their heads. And in the case of the Orioles, it just seems like they have enough guys where they're actually just a bunch of fireballers. And they've taken on a lot of guys where either they're like former failed pitching prospects. I mean, that's the easiest way to be a great reliever, right? Is like, I never could sustain 5 innings, but if I just throw as hard as I can.
I mean, that's what they did with Zach Britton. That's what Zach Britton was. They had him in the starting rotation, and he was like a very average starter in like 2012. And then they started giving him the ninth in, I don't know, 2014, 2013, somewhere around there. And he just was incredible in that role. So, yeah, I mean, you're exactly right.
And like guys like Bauman, who would have been forgotten to history, you know, even if he's not the best, you know, reliever ever or whatever, like if a dude can come in and throw 99 miles an hour, you're probably going to have a pretty decent shot, like, right, of being like productive. And, you know, they have a lot of guys who are either just absolutely disgusting, like Bautista and Cano, and then a lot of guys that are just really quality. Even the guy that got in the deadline, Fujinami, like his numbers are awful. The dude threw 103 today. Like, you'd think they probably can mine a little bit more out of that than the Athletics could, you know? They've just built this kind of supercharged engine as a bullpen, and it's just all the problems that I have with them just feel irrelevant because of how good the offense is and how good the bullpen has been. It's just, it's a really crazy, you know, visual experience considering how, like I said, it felt like it flipped so quickly, you know, compared to maybe what anyone ever thought. we mentioned Jack Flaherty earlier. Did you feel like they did enough at the deadline? Like, how would you have approached that situation when you have a team that probably should be competing for the pennant? You know, I we'll see if it gets to that point, right? But like, certainly in the mix, even if you don't think they're necessarily the best team in the American League. Do you think they should have gone a little bit harder than they did? Because I think that was my general position. But also, you know, it also comes to who was available. But how did you feel about that?
So I totally get if your position is, look, the Orioles have arguably the best farm in baseball right now. They have a shitload of good prospects. You have a real, like, contender here in the American League. Like, go burn some of your prospects and add some, like, really quality starters to your rotation. Like, really go after this thing because you have the assets and you have the team and, like, the time is right. That's a totally respectable position to have. I think historically the results bear out that, like, that is a way to find success in the postseason. It is a way to win the World Series. When you have the assets, go be a buyer at the trade deadline. I don't mind them saying, hey, let's take a soft touch with this. Like, we're still pretty young. We're still pretty early in the timeline and the window of all things Baltimore right now. Like, we don't need to be dramatic with the makeup of this team. I'm okay with that. I really like the Flaherty ad because you have to look, I mean, baseball is in particular is one of these sports where you have to look at everything in the context of the decision that it was made in. And they added Flaherty because they just sent Tyler Wells down to AA. Tyler Wells is in Bowie now.
So
and
weird.
They, you know, he's pitched 113 innings this year. He's pitched like something like 275 since the start of the 2021 season. They have to replace his arm. And so they don't need Flaherty to go be sick 2019 St. Louis Flaherty. They need him to be Tyler Wells and maybe a little bit better. And then that's a win for them. And if they can take sort of this distressed asset, like they have taken so many other, you know, names from around baseball the last couple of years, if they can take a distressed asset like Flaherty, who hasn't been pitching well, and get him, I don't know, like 80% back to where he was at his best, that's a great win that you add at the deadline for, I mean, I'm not... Like, there are people that probably know a lot more about the Orioles farm system than I do. I don't think any of the guys they gave away are, like, that awesome.
I've heard some about Drew Rahm. Like, I know these are interesting guys, but nothing that's – like, these are not guys that you are, you know, clutching over.
They didn't give away, like, the A-quality stuff here. Yeah. So I kind of like the soft touch approach. I think it's totally reasonable to disagree, but I like that – the approach to me kind of signaled, hey, we think we have a pretty good squad here. Like, we really like the locker room chemistry and the clubhouse and like the, all these young guys and the energy. And we're just going to kind of let that percolate as it has been and add, you know, sort of in smaller dimensions. And we're going to see how that turns out because, like, we haven't seen the Orioles in the playoffs since 2016. So
yeah,
like, they're not going to mess with it too bad. And I'm really interested in that approach.
Yeah, it's just, I think there was some room. Flaherty is a good buy low guy, you know, where it's like, yeah, just eat some innings and maybe there's some more to mine out, especially if you're throwing harder. But because he's a rental, you know, you got 2 months to figure that out. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. He's probably not going to be an Oriole next year unless he falls in love with the place, right?
Crap.
And so... it's just, I wish there was something, because of all these guys you mentioned, right, like Tyler Wells, almost every single person on the Orioles roster is about to hit their innings career high, if they're not well over already. Mm. Basically, the only person that doesn't apply to is Kyle Gibson. And, like, Kyle Gibson's your, do you want to call him your staff ace? I don't know what to call Kyle Gibson. Is he your
elite Hall of Fame pitcher, Kyle Gibson?
Is he your game one starter?
Probably, yeah.
Like, that doesn't sound good, you know? Like,
I mean, but everybody knows the deal with them, though. Everybody knows they're not, like, rolling out six starting pitching.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to give up six runs in the first four innings of a playoff, of game two of the ALDS this year. Like, everybody knows that. And the, you know, the meta is going to be, can they win anyway, even though they, you know, can they make it count in the seventh inning when they do have, you know, the setup guys and the closers guys coming in, and it's unlikely that the other team is going to score more than one run the rest of the way. Can the offense recover from a bad starting pitching performance? That's going to be what dictates what the Orioles do in the playoffs or the stretch run here in August and September, not what the starting pitching does, because that's just not how they built this team.
And yeah, and those are all totally, you know, valid. And I think maybe the easiest way to explain it is Dylan Cease was like the only actual good pitcher on the market, and the White Sox were probably asking for the world because they didn't have to move him. And so in situations like that, you know, I didn't want to be overly critical of the Orioles. I get bored of the let's just wait and see how things develop, you know, and sometimes it could work great. You know, maybe a lot of these guys hit and it's just, those are just the menace for the next 6 years, you know? We just saw the Mets basically just rip through money to accomplish the opposite, right? Like, they fueled their farm system like that. Like, the Orioles can take on salary. You know, it's not like they can't spend more than they have. They're barely spending right now. Like, you couldn't have found, like I mentioned before, Lance Lynn was being paid too much, and he was terrible the first half of the year. I would still rather have plugged him in, or, you know, had guys like that where we're not even giving up anything. We're just taking on money and having a guy that will give Dean Kramer's arm a break, you know? So I do understand mindset, and you can only like make trades based on what's being offered, right? Like, there aren't like magical guys that are probably right. available that we don't know about. We know the guys that are available, you know?
I think they will, to your point, probably take several passes. I think this offseason is the offseason, regardless of what happens in the playoffs, where they go, okay, we got it in place here. What are the arms we can go get? Mm-hmm. We have a payroll of like $42 million in a division where everybody's payroll is ridiculous. Yeah. Like, let's go add some really strong arms and be the favorite for 2024. And I think they can do that.
Yeah. Like, I think them and the Mariners would be a really natural trading partner this offseason if they wanted to get creative. You know, Logan Gilbert was a guy that still has a few years left. It's not like he's like an impending free agent or anything. It's just that the Mariners have been able to develop all these pitchers and they can't get a hitter to save their life, you know? And the Orioles are kind of, you know, they have interesting pitchers in the minors, but, you know, they have like five outfielders they probably should be playing next year. And, you know, maybe you could give up one or two of them and figure something out. So I think there are definitely big growth opportunities for the Orioles, and I'm curious how that shakes out this offseason. Maybe the opportunity just wasn't there. But I hope they don't sit on their hands, you know, because I do think this team is really good, and the farm system is so good that this is going to be a whirlwind. You know, it's going to be like a big deal for a couple of years if this turns out as well as it seems like it will, especially if Jackson Holliday, who will be here in Richmond this week, if he is that guy, then this team is on a rocket ship, you know, so I hope that isn't squandered. I had a couple more questions for you, and I wanted to get this one out of the way just before we kind of end with, you know, the broad perspective on the rest of the season. But I have very strong feelings about what they've done to Camden, and I love the stadium, but that left field wall drives me crazy. And am I in the wrong to just hate beyond anything else that exists in baseball?
Beyond anything else in baseball seems a bit extreme.
Like domestic abusers, one. Like, people that cheat in baseball, two. And then Camden left field wall, three.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel that strongly about it. I definitely thought when they did it, I was like, whoa, that's okay. That's different. So I had a reaction too. But I think ultimately it doesn't change how I feel about the park. It's just, you know, it's a wall. Like it's, and it does,
it's a wall.
You know, it changes how the park plays for sure. I mean, how could it not? And it is, I think, a little weird to have the left field wall the way it is, but then the porch in right. It's a funky thing. And I do think it takes away a little bit from like the classic feel that Camden had. Yeah.
That's why I felt, you know, if it was any other state, if it was Nationals Park, I'd be like, sure, why do I care?
Right, like, who cares? It's Nats Park. Like, it's 20 years old. Who cares? But I think the case for it is, like, Camden had become such a matchbox. I mean, people, it was just bomb, 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 bomb. And I do think it kind of challenges that now, where it is a little bit more balanced of a park, even if it's unbalanced in how it is balanced, if that makes any sense.
And like, it's if unbalanced, you seen, it balances it out.
Exactly. If you haven't seen Camden, you're like, I don't really understand. Like, those words don't make sense in that order, but it is kind of what it is. It's like, it's a weird yin yang thing between left field and right field. It's the best way I could probably describe it.
Counteracting how insane right field is, you know, cause right field is just like, and I think it's very interesting.
Yeah.
A lot of their top prospects are lefty slugger types, right? Where, you know, Gunnar Henderson, Adley, I mean, Adley's best side is the left. And then Jackson Holliday are going to be in the same lineup together.
So are you going conspiracy here? Or are you going like,
this is purely
as a strategic thing? Because that's not crazy.
Like, for me, it's purely aesthetic and like baseball, like, you know, like enthusiasts talking. Like, I just don't like it. Because if your decision is, let me carve out like a cake slice from one of the best ballparks in America that looks terrible and makes like home runs that are home runs in every other place in the world, like doubles or outs, like I hate that, you know, and there's no way for me to like appreciate that. But like I don't think there's any conspiracy, but I wonder if that helps them prioritize certain things, you know, because look at Ryan Mountcastle. Like, he is just like, he's a fine hitter, you know, he's flawed, but he hits the ball really hard. But then it like means nothing. Like, everything Ryan Mountcastle hits is like dead. You know, unless he hits it to center field, or like it's like 400. You basically have to hit 450 to like reliably get a home run in Camden Yards left field now. You know? So I think you brought up, because I haven't thought about it as like a grand conspiracy yet, although that would be a really fun position to take, so maybe I'll workshop that in my head. But, you know, Jackson Holliday is not like super power, like raw power guy, right? Like, he's 19 and looks like he's 12, and he's a really good hitter, but he's not a ton of power. That's not going to matter.
You just described half the Orioles roster, by the way.
Absolutely correct.
19 looks like he's 12.
But he is going to be able to send balls over the right field fence, like, no problem. And then he's going to hit 300 everywhere else. So, you know, it's going to be a big asset to them having, you know, an easy to hit right field in particular for them, because they're going to have the best stretch of lefties in baseball, right? Who else could possibly even, mm-hmm. like, if those three guys are as good as we think they are, not going to be close. So it just felt so unnecessary what they did to left field. And like I said, just the idea that guys are hitting balls that should very clearly be home runs, like everything we know about home runs and feel like home runs, and then it's not a home run. You know those?
Yeah, like 410 to left, and that might not be enough.
Yeah, like if a guy feels like it should be a home run, then it probably just should be. And that's like a really dumb way to describe it. But I think players have a pretty good idea of when they just, oh man, yeah, that felt good. And then it's like at like 405 in near the corner, you know, it's like, ugh, it just bothered me from there. But is that where the bird bath is too? Like the birds, the water, water gun section.
I'm not sure. Is it?
I can't remember where they put it. If that's where they put it, it redeems it a little bit for me, because I think that's hilarious. Then they got the, you know, beer bong home run celebration. So they got they've made it up in a little bit of ways, because obviously Camden is cool in Baltimore, you know.
Yeah, I think it is. Right. I think it is over there.
That spares it a little bit for me, but I just, you know, it's just been a thing that nags at me whenever I watch them, you know. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just like a curmudgeon, but I hate like weird. I hate it when part choices are made just because.
Yeah, and it felt like this is just kind of have to be some level of curmudgeon to do a baseball podcast, though. I mean, yeah, like, this absolutely doesn't even work if you don't have that in you.
But that's why I'm like sharing this, because I had to have some. I'm a very modern baseball fan, you know. I'm good with stats. I like changes, but I had to have certain things I put my foot down on, you know. And that thing for me is Orioles left field fence. So, the rest of the way, we're thinking about Baltimore. You know, you mentioned, you know, you obviously don't expect them to be World Series champions or whatever, right? But where do you see this team progressing over the next couple months? And even just maybe into the future? You know, I think beginning of the season for Gunnar was kind of weird, because he was doing a lot of things right and he just couldn't hit the ball. And now he's just hitting everything. And then we've seen what Adley can do. We've seen what Jackson Holliday's doing in the minors, and we're seeing what Cedric and Austin Hayes and these guys do. How do you think this season plays out?
Santander.
I mean,
old reliable.
Yeah, like so many guys are just like, how is this happening? Remember when Cedric Mullins was a bunt specialist?
I do remember that. Yeah.
That was not long ago. And now he's, you know, top five center fielder in baseball. You know, what are you looking for? What do you want versus what do you expect?
Well, I mean, look, I have low expectations. I have very little sports fandom history with like truly successful teams.
Yeah.
So I think what I want, I don't know, man, just like a fun postseason would be nice. Like, and if that's going to game five and losing, I mean, like, I'm good with that. Like, you know, it's the first playoff berth in 7 years for this franchise. So kind of anything at this point is gravy. I think making it to the ALCS probably feels about right, not necessarily winning it. Maybe even like getting curb stomped in the ALCS, I think would kind of make some sense. On some level, I think my bigger expectations are from like, okay, this is working. Where do we now go from here? And that's where a franchise that has been very, very on the cheap the last few years needs to show the money at some point. And I think that's where I start to have some expectations of like, hey, if this team has a payroll of like $48 million next year, like that's a little weird. That's at that point, that's a little weird. And I would like to see, you know, I think they should go into 2024, like really feeling it. I think if they're not like one of the two or three favorites going into 2024, I think they've done something really wrong. And that's where I think my expectations are going to pick up more so than this year, where it's like, all right, we've got proof of concept. Definitely. Like, this worked. Where do we go from here?
It was kind of playing with house money the rest of the way.
I think so.
And then, yeah. And then this offseason, it's like, okay, now that we are a contender, we're firmly in there. We got to see the money start, or, you know, even trades and stuff. Like, there's so many. That's the thing about them. There's so many good opportunities just waiting. I mean, at what point are we going to, even if it's via text or whatever, are we going to have the conversation of, hey, are the Orioles going to make an offer for Ohtani? No, like, is that the most outlandish thing that could be said? Because, like, a team that is really good and could afford a guy for $50 million a year, you know, I think that's a pretty
it's a good really match interesting idea. Because, on the one hand, financially, you're absolutely right. On the other hand, it would be weird if Ohtani was making more than the entire rest of the team.
At the same time, that would be kind of funny.
I mean, it would be hilarious, but that feels like, and it just doesn't feel like a move that Baltimore makes. Like, that's not what that front office is going to do.
It doesn't at all. And I thought they should have been more aggressive. Like, what if they went out and signed Trey Turner this offseason? like, that looks terrible now. But like, that's, I'm like, hey, they could afford that and it wouldn't be that hard to believe. It's just, right. But it's, you know, all the history of the Orioles says probably rather not. I think they're, I wonder if Chris Davis made them trigger shy in a lot of ways. And I wonder how the management, you know, because obviously the management is all Astros, you know, like we know what to do. And then the ownership is still the Angelos, you know, like we're only going to get so far with, you know, how this thing works, I think.
Yeah.
I'm very curious to see what that next step looks like. And I think a natural, easy way of doing it would be, like I mentioned before, where you say, hey, we can take on this guy that you might not love anymore and is getting paid $20 million next year. We'll just take him on and we can plug him into our rotation. We can plug him into left field, whatever, you know, wherever they're looking for spots. And, you know, he's an upgrade for us. And we'll, what is it? The pitching lab and stuff like that they have. I feel like that's becoming like a kind of a famous thing now, the Baltimore pitching lab. You know, we'll work on guys and they'll come out better. And we didn't have to give up anything because other teams were paying them money and didn't really want them on the team anymore. I think there's lots of opportunities for them to upgrade really, really easily. And I hope they take advantage of that. The last question that I had, and this is just me trying to kind of tap into the Orioles brain right now. Are there any of the current Orioles that you've kind of planted your flag on as like, that's my guy? Because I know when the team has multiple kind of stars or superstars that seem to be on the way, I think different people gravitate toward different people. Is everyone just all in on Adley, or is it kind of like you're a gunner guy, or you're a blah blah blah? Like, do you have any strong feelings that way?
I mentioned my wife does not really follow sports. She watched the home run derby with me.
Oh, yeah.
Last month, and she was like, I would like an Adley Rutschman shirt, please. What are they called? Are they called jerseys? Are they called shirts in baseball?
Just if it has his name on it is what I want.
But yeah, it needs to read Rutschman. What's his name? I want that shirt. When we go, we're going to the Rocky series at the end of this month. Like, I want that shirt. So the Adley hype is very real, and she's from Maryland. So, like, she's not faking it just for me. She is. She's an O's girl. For me, it's actually Santander,
really?
It sounds insane, but he was there when they sucked, and he was still good when they sucked, but nobody was paying attention to it because they sucked, and like, you know, unless you were deep in the weeds of like O's baseball, you were not paying attention to anybody's numbers on that team. I appreciate that, like. I don't know how his numbers pull up in front of me, but like in 2019 or, you know, 2021, he's hitting 25 home runs and however many RBIs, and like he had pretty good numbers on a real shit team. And it's been cool to a couple years later, fast forward, and there is this entire roster now around him and like how good they are, and he's just still like just chipping away, just like super consistent. Doesn't talk a lot, like very quiet, and it's been like, he's obviously not the sexiest name on the roster, but it has been cool to watch his numbers just be really reliable while the entire rest of the operation gets built around him.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, he was like a fun fantasy guy when they were crap, you know, because like, oh, he's hitting 25, 30 home runs and he can do stuff. And, you know, he's not a perfect player, but as someone, you know, the Braves have only had one version of this, right? That was a few years ago. But seeing the guys that managed to stick around or like find their way through it is really satisfying, you know, and I totally understand, like, you know, that natural affinity. Even, I mean, Rutschman's like made in a lab to like be like easily rooted for guy imaginable, you know,
super marketable. Yeah. And like, yeah, I mean
he spits totally out, I think you should leave quotes like that. I think that's all I needed, you know, become a fan of his. Like, but there is something to be said about these guys that, you know, were not super relevant guys but figured it out along the way. Like Mullins, like we were saying, Mullins is kind of in the same boat. Austin Hayes was a really big prospect that was not working out. You know, he got hurt really, really bad, came back, was not really that good, and has kind of emerged as a really interesting guy, even if he's, you know, more of a trade chip now. Who knows kind of what his future is. And that's kind of an interesting thing with Santander is, is he an Oriole next year? No, I think there's like, I don't know what they do if they have 12 guys that could replace him. Right. No, but he's clearly. And
does he still want to be there? Is he like, hey, like I took you through this period. Like, I'm gonna go find. I'm sure somebody else will pay him more money. Like, no question. Somewhere else he can find more money.
Yeah.
So it'll be sad if that happens, which I suspect it will. But I mean, Mancini's the other part of this, where like, you want to talk about dudes I loved. Like, how could you not love Trey Mancini? And when they let him go last year, I totally understood why they did it, but I was like, man, like, this sucks.
It hurts.
Because Mancini was just such a, like, beyond even just, like, the story of it, like, he was that team when they were bad. He represented everything that you wanted with a bad team, which was, boy, we suck. But one day, like, yeah. That's what if we had more of those guys? Like, it kind of sucks that you don't get to see, like, the great Baltimore team that they have now this year with Mancini on the roster hitting dingers along with everybody else. But at the same time, if you have, like, I don't know how much, like, alpha really matters. But, like, you can only have so many of those guys in the locker room. And if you have Trey Mancini there, what happens with Adley? What happens with Henderson? Like, it's just, I don't know. So, it's kind of a tough. Yeah.
it's weird. And, yeah.
I don't even know how to land the plane on that. It's just it's one of those things where you don't quite know how all the ingredients mix together if you've got too many dudes.
Yeah. It's going to be a really fascinating transition period for them to being fun to real, you know, and we're already seeing it. It's just, but what's it going to look like, you know, in its final form, you know, and are Santander and Austin Hayes and these guys even a part of that? Who knows, you know, so they're really interesting, but that's also why I wanted to chat with you and kind of get your perspective on it, because it's about as fun of a baseball team to watch and talk about. So really glad, you know, you got to do that. I think that was all the questions I had and all the, you know, topics we wanted to chat about. Is there anything you want to plug? Obviously, I mentioned Lion's Edge podcast. If you want to give an idea of where people can find that and where people can find your other work.
Yeah, so Lion's Edge podcast, like you said, a podcast I do for BetMGM, just kind of coming out of our little podcast off season. I got married in the spring, and so I took some time off for that. So coming back in July, we've got a couple episodes of the book. There's actually a new one out pretty much right now out July 7th on Monday. And that is between me and the director of trading at MGM, Christian Cipollini. And so some really cool insight from, like, inside the sports book about how the numbers work and, like, dispelling a lot of sort of pop culture-y myths about sports betting and, like, stuff that gets repeated a lot that people think is true, but it's not true, or it's kind of true, but here's a pretty important piece of context you need to remember when you're thinking about this. This is just, like, really, really good, like, base level stuff. And if you're interested in sports betting at any level, if you're like really into it and you do it all the time, if you are like a casual bettor, if you're not really into it at all, but you'd like to know a little bit more about how it works, just like for personal knowledge to understand something that's super, you know, in the culture right now.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good episode to listen to. Even if you're like, this podcast isn't for me, I think this episode in particular is really interesting. And then just in general, like, it's a lot of me talking about, you know, in season college football bets for this week, NFL bets for this week. I'm actually in the Circa Survivor contest, the big contest in Las Vegas that has $8 million payout this year. So I'm sure I'll be talking about my entry in that a lot this fall, and just like looking at markets, looking at numbers. Like, it's if that's the sort of thing you're into, it's a really good podcast from inside of the sports book. And it's a fun podcast to do because obviously I work for a sports book, my paychecks get signed by a sports book. So like, that's who I'm in bed with. But at the same time, I think about it, I think like any journalist would, which is like, I'm in business with the listener. I'm in business with the better, and I'm doing the content for them from inside of the sports book. And it's a hard balance to try to set, but I think when done right, it produces really compelling content. So there's that. And then I also write a lot for the BetMGM blog, and you can check that link out if you're looking for some of my written content. Just head over to my Twitter at ChaseAKitty, and you can see tons of links from me and from BetMGM to all the stuff that I write for their blog.
Yeah. And as long as I've known you, I am not a gambling person. You know, we've talked a little bit, you know, I've dabbled here and there. I'm more of a fantasy person if I'm talking about, you know, throwing money on anything, but you've always had an approachable way of talking about it, even if I'm not on the same page about everything, you know, so highly recommend, especially in this circumstance, right, where it's someone explaining the inside workings of it in this newest episode you got. That sounds really cool. So I'll definitely be listening to that tomorrow.
It's about visibility, I think, because especially gambling, there's such a high barrier. It's a low barrier to entry, but the vocabulary and all of the, I mean, there's so many fake people. There's so many people like out there, like talking the talk. Absolutely. And like, oh yeah, I hit 75% winners and I haven't lost a game in 19 days. And like, it's just so much bullshit in the space. There's so much bullshit.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to like try to do a good podcast with real information from inside of a real sports book about like, this is what it's actually like. Like, this is what you need to do to hit 52%. And like, you know, hit break even, turn a profit, even if it's marginal. So that's what I try to do. It's not the biggest podcast in the world, but we do okay. And we have a pretty cool community.
Yep. And especially for college football fans, you know, the amount that you've taught to me about college football is, you know, more than I'll ever pretend to know. So, you know, college football, college basketball, definitely within, and you know, NFL, obviously, I mean, I think every gambling related thing has to be talking about NFL, you know, in some form.
Yeah.
So
it's currency of the realm. So yeah.
So if you're into that kind of stuff, that is a perfect place to look. So thank you again, Chase. And let's do this again, especially if the Orioles, you know, they make a little bit of a run here. You know, maybe have you back in the playoffs.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Awesome. Delay Radio is produced by Lewis. This episode was hosted by Dylan, and thank you to our guest, Chase Kitty. Rain Delay Radio was edited by Nime. Our theme music was composed by Chuck Leese. Rain Delay Radio releases every Monday morning at 1 a.m. Eastern, and we will catch you next week. Ooh.